Good morning. One evening, an old Cherokee chief told his grandson about a battle that goes on inside people. He said, "My son, the battle is between two wolves. One is evil. It is anger, envy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, lies, false pride, superiority, and ego. The other is good. It is joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith." The grandson thought about it for a minute and then asked, "Grandfather, which wolf wins?" The old Cherokee chief simply replied, "The one you feed." In this morning's gospel reading from John, it is pretty apparent which wolves Mary and Judas are feeding. The text is presented in John's gospel immediately following the raising of Mary's brother Lazarus from the dead. When Lazarus has emerged from the tomb, dazed and still reeking of death, the gospel adds that the chief priests and Pharisees are plotting to arrest Jesus. So this short but telling text presages Jesus' trial and crucifixion. The scene is about as homely as it gets. The little family of Mary, Martha, and Lazarus give a dinner for Jesus. Martha and Mary perform their usual roles. Martha serves and Mary is at Jesus' feet, thus preparing the drama that will unfold between Mary and Judas. The focus of that drama is a pound of pure nard, a costly perfume we're told worth 300 denarii. In those days, a common laborer would earn about one denarius a day, so this is pretty close to a year's salary. One commentator puts the cost at about $30,000 in today's money. So here's the thing. What Judas says initially makes sense. Why not have sold the money and put it in the common purse to be given to the poor? Wouldn't that have been the right thing to do? But immediately as these words are said, we are given the true motivation. Judas doesn't care about the poor, and furthermore, he's been dipping into the offering plate. We understand who Judas is and what he is thinking. Judas is a thief and a betrayer. But the gospel doesn't share Mary's thoughts or feelings. We can only interpret those based on her actions. By opening up the costly perfume, she is filling that little house with an overpowering fragrance. Imagine dumping out an entire bottle of Chanel No. 5, and you'll get the idea. The fragrance, we imagine, overcomes that stink of death that Lazarus carried when he emerged from the tomb. By anointing Jesus' feet, Mary is demonstrating her gratitude and her great love for Jesus. But I would also suggest that Mary's actions are political as well. Mary is a woman and therefore less valued in her society, and she's not welcome at the table. That makes her vulnerable to the scorn of both men in the text, Judas and Jesus. When she risks her very being to dump that bottle of perfume on Jesus' feet and then wipe his feet with her hair, she does so as a matter of faith and politics. She risks everything she has and everything she is to perform this act of love, just as Jesus will soon risk everything he has and everything he is to die on the cross. But while Mary incurs Judas's wrath, Jesus supports her. "Leave her alone. She bought it so that she might keep it for the day of my burial. You always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me." Notice that Jesus says, "You always have the poor with you." He doesn't say that the poor are all around you, the poor are nearby, the poor are outside somewhere. He says that the poor are with you, with you. They are meant to be a part of the community. They are meant to serve alongside the gathered church. They are meant to be seen as human beings. The poor are not simply objects of charity, but they are companions on the journey, those with whom we share our bread and our lives. As Nelson Mandela once said, overcoming poverty is not a task of charity. It is an act of justice. And justice, to be any kind of justice at all, is restorative. While charity is a one-time event, justice is a lifelong process. With true justice, there is no other. There is only us. In 1978, a man named Michael Kerwin was living in Washington, D.C., and looking forward to a conventional career of some sort. Then one night, his life changed forever. In an article written in 1991, Kerwin said this, "I was out walking one night near the State Department, only a block from my apartment. It was bitterly cold as I passed a heating vent at 21st and Virginia Avenue Northwest. And there was a man sitting there. He called out to me and asked for a dollar to buy a bowl of soup. I ignored him and kept on walking. I still remember being very irritated and annoyed that he had disturbed my peace. He kept calling after me. I stopped about a block away and thought to myself, I'll fix him. He doesn't want soup. He just wants a drink. That's what they all want. I'll go up to my apartment and fix him some soup, and that'll serve him right. I did this and brought the soup down, set it down, and walked away. I don't remember if he thanked me or not, and I didn't care. I didn't want to know anything about him. I just wanted to be spiteful." Kerwin writes, "I never saw that man again. I hadn't cared what it had made him feel, but I had just helped someone. And actually, there wasn't too much to it, and I felt pretty good about that. The next evening, I made more soup and a few sandwiches and some hot tea, and I took the food out to some other men on the heating vent, and I put it down and walked away. I still didn't talk to them. I was still afraid as well as nervous and very embarrassed. They thanked me, not even knowing what I had brought, but grateful anyhow, it seemed, for the gesture." Well, it was after this that things got really interesting. Kerwin continues, "I kept doing that night after night, repeating the same menu, but gradually bringing down larger and larger containers as more and more people seemed to congregate for the food I was bringing. One night, as I brought down a large gallon jug of hot split pea soup and set it down, a rather rough-looking fellow picked up the jar of soup and in one motion broke the jar over my head. The soup ran down my clothes. It was boiling hot and it burned me, but I was too afraid to feel it. But instead of running away, I asked the man why he had done that. They were probably the first words I had ever spoken to any of them. He told me that I was doing nothing more than bringing food to the dogs. I was treating all of them like pets. I was bringing food, setting it down like I was feeding them out of a pet dish, and then just walking away. He said, 'Talk to us, visit with us. We don't bite.' I told him that I was afraid of him, that I didn't know what to say. But I did tell him that from now on, when I did come with food, I would stay and visit if they wanted me to. If not, I would just leave. What happened that night, Kerwin says, was that a first barrier had been broken in my perceptions of who homeless people are. I realized that these men and women on the street had feelings just like me. They wanted to be loved and cared about and respected and listened to. They cared that someone cared about them, but just giving them food and a blanket wasn't enough. So began Michael Kerwin's career as a Catholic worker in Washington, D.C. Until his death from cancer in 1999, Kerwin's message was this: it is community and in community that we find love, and in love there is no ending. It's almost as if Judas becomes Mary, isn't it? Are Judas and Mary written as opposite sides of the same coin, examples of the war within each of us, the battle over which wolf we ultimately choose to feed? Because Judas says all the right words, and if you didn't know his heart, you might think he was right. But the right words don't always make for a just world. I love what Marcus Borg has to say about that in his book, Convictions. In it, he writes, "Believing matters, though not in its most common modern Christian meaning, namely believing a set of statements about God, the Bible, and Jesus to be true, even when they seem questionable. That is a serious distortion of the biblical and pre-modern Christian meanings of believing. Its authentic meaning is better conveyed by the word beloving. Believing in the modern sense of the word has little transformative power. One can believe all of the right things and still be quite untransformed. But what we beloved shapes our lives and has great transformative power." In this text, Mary is beloving a new world into being. She does so by taking a great risk to show Jesus that she understands exactly who he is and just what will happen to him. But I also think it's more than that. John's gospel takes up great pains to set up Jesus as a king. Not a king in the corrupt way of the world, but a king who will usher in a new kingdom of true justice, love, and peace. A kingdom that will become, as we like to say, kingdom. A world in which all of us share equally and fairly. I think that Mary is making her own declaration. Caesar is not her king. Jesus is. That is an act of politics and an act of faith. That is an act of true discipleship and an enactment of love that she will perform over and over again in Jesus' name after he is gone. All this Mary seems to do intuitively and seamlessly. Mary is a true disciple. She is acting out the great commandment that Jesus gave to all his disciples: love one another as I have loved you. Jesus chose to die on the cross, demonstrating that his love for humanity had no limits. I don't believe that he died to save us from our sin, but in his dying, he showed us how to live and how to love in this world, and demonstrated a love that gave absolutely everything away. But even the church itself has struggled with that notion for centuries. This is what Franciscan friar and writer Richard Rohr had to say in a recent devotion. "In all honesty," Rohr writes, "once it was on top and fully part of the establishment, the church was a bit embarrassed by the powerless one, Jesus. We had to make his obvious defeat into a glorious victory that had nothing to do with defeat, his or ours. Let's face it, we feel more comfortable with power than with powerlessness. Who wants to be like Jesus on the cross, the very icon of powerlessness? It just doesn't look like a way of influence, a way of access, a way that's going to make any difference in the world. We are such a strange religion," Rohr says. "We worship this naked, bleeding loser crucified outside the walls of Jerusalem, but we always want to be winners, powerful and on top ourselves, at least until we learn to love the little things and the so-called little people. And then we often see that they are not little at all, but often better images of ourselves. Rohr points out that the poor and the outcast in our society can be our best teachers in the way of the gospel. They represent what we are most afraid of within ourselves, what we most deny within ourselves. He adds, one of the most transformative experiences is entering into some form of lifestyle solidarity with the powerless. It's like changing sides from the ego side of things, and this is what changes you. Rohr says, we don't think ourselves into a new way of living. We live ourselves into a new way of thinking. It is lifestyle choices that convert people. He concludes, I'm not aware that merely believing a doctrine or a dogma has ever converted anybody. I think that's just what Marcus Bork said. I think that's just what Michael Kerwin learned in one shattering, life-changing moment, and just what Mary lived out by choosing to become vulnerable and lay down everything she was to serve Jesus. And Judas made his choice as well, turning his back on community, justice, and love. Our choices can enrich us or they can impoverish us. I once knew a man named Robert who began attending a church I was a part of because he had been coming to the AA group that met there. Robert was different from everyone else in that church. They were all pretty much middle-class folks, and Robert had been homeless. And when he came to church, he showed up in torn jeans and shabby shoes. And yet, Robert had dignity and vision and faith. And Robert wanted to be a part of that church. When he first started attending services, Robert came to the coffee hour and he stood off to one side of the room. I'm sorry to say that there were people in that room who didn't want to acknowledge his presence. No one paid any attention to him at all, except a few of us who were sitting across the room. I was so uncomfortable that he was standing there all by himself that I went over to ask him to join our table. With some encouragement, he finally came over. From that moment on, he and the people at that table became fast friends. They adopted one another, not through some random act of charity, but in recognition of kinship. And they recognized their kinship even in their differences. Robert went on to be one of the most faithful servants we had at our weekly dinner program, helping to cook and serve food and then sitting down to share a meal with people who were lonely. Robert had the vision to find Jesus in a church where Jesus could have easily been overlooked by people who said all the right things, just as Robert would have been overlooked but for a few kindred spirits. We would have missed out on Robert's depth and inner beauty and his great capacity to serve from the love that poured out of his heart. I knew Robert over 20 years ago, and I've never forgotten him. Robert changed my life. In the end, ministry is not about counting the cost of our actions or anyone else's actions. Ministry is not about saying the correct words of faith, because anyone can do that, even Judas. But ministry is about beloving a new world into being, about laying down our hearts and our lives in extravagant living that declares to the powers of this world that our allegiance is with Jesus, that we choose to walk with the poor and the outcast, that we choose to enact a new world into being. Then and only then will we, as Richard Rohr says, live ourselves into a new way of thinking. Then and only then will the many unjust kingdoms of this world come tumbling down and be transformed into one kingdom of love and justice and peace. Then and only then will we truly remove the stink of death and oppression from this world and fill it instead with the overwhelming, overpowering fragrance of love. For that I say, thanks be to God.